When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by EarDial, the invisible earplug specially designed for live music. If you go to concerts or festivals, you need to protect your hearing. The sound level at most music venues can cause ringing in your ears and hearing loss. With EarDial, you will still hear the music at full fidelity, but at a safe level. They're very discreet and no one will realise you're wearing them. With the app included, you can know the sound level around you and how long you can stay safely at that level. With their compact case, you can have them in your keychain at all times with you. And from now until the end of September 2019, Guitar Nerds listeners can receive a 20% discount on all EarDial earplugs. Just follow the link in the description of this podcast episode or visit eardial.com/guitar nerds. This week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Orange Amplifiers and their Tremlord 30 guitar app. A very orange take on a classic, cool 1950s amplifier. It's a 30-watt 112 all-valve guitar combo with 2-foot switchable valve-driven tremolo speeds and 2-spring reverb tank. Everything you need to deliver high-quality, vintage-inspired, boutique-esque tones in the near-indestructible chassis of an Orange Amplifier. Harking back to tremolos made famous in the 50s, the 12AX7 valve-powered tremolo oozes versatility and depth. With crystal clear clarity and buckets of headroom, the Orange Tremolo 30 is the latest in Orange's run of meticulously designed pin-drop perfect amplifiers. Visit orangeamps.com/tremlord for a detailed overview, sound samples, and links to dealers worldwide. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds podcast, the 233rd episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Matt Knight.
Hello there.
And Blake Weiland.
Woo,
yeah, that's right. We've got Blake from the Tone Mob and Chasing Tone. That's right. It's a whole new lineup of Guitar Nerds podcast for
podcast
us tonight.
Inception. I was going to say interception, but more like inception.
No, yes, it's podcast
within
inception.
A podcast.
That's right. We've got no more J. Cross. J. Cross is in America.
What? How do these guys get
he's
holiday?
In America?
How come I don't have any holiday?
Yeah, J. Cross has taken some holiday, and he's gone with his girlfriend Maddie to, I imagine, Philadelphia. I think that's where she's from. She's always telling me to support the Philadelphia Phillies when I've started to try and get into baseball recently. So I assume they're in Philadelphia. But yeah, they're there, and Mark Packham's taking a month off. So, you know, it's...
He's taking a month off. I'm just trying to figure out a day off, and he's taking
a
month off?
Yeah, well, you know, Mark needs, you know, his rest. He needs to recharge his batteries. He needs to think of new ideas, and every now and again, he likes to quit the podcast for a brief period of time. he thinks it makes it more exciting when he comes back. You know, it's like daytime television when someone dies and then they come back as their twin. I think it's kind of that sort of thing for
them.
But yes, we are. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But yeah, unfortunately, we are markless for a month. But absolutely wonderful that we've got you on, Blake, because it's the first time we've had you on a regular episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. And yes, and as the most probably the most knowledgeable person in all of guitar podcasting, that is wonderful to have you here.
That is not true. And if it is, everyone should be terrified, because I am just flying by the seat of my pants over here. So
there we go. Well, okay, fine. Certainly the first person to do guitar podcasting. We'll grant you that mantle.
I don't think, anyway, I get that one either.
Really? Don't you?
No.
You definitely do.
Guys were doing it before I did.
Really?
You guys beat me by a couple years.
Oh my God, I'm pretty sure you were the first podcast I was listening to. I guess I didn't listen to podcasts when I started. I was drinking. Anyway, we should delve straight into guitar stuff. Something I'm trying to do. You know, I'm trying to bring down sort of the intro time. I'm aware that new listeners would get put off if we talk about sort of guff for too long at the start of a podcast. But then Jay always tries to sort of waylay the podcast and make me talk about guff for longer because he likes the idea that less people would listen. I think he likes the idea of sort of, you know, putting us out of business. So, but anyway, we should talk about guitar stuff. So I was thinking, as we've got you on the podcast this week, Blake, and you're a massive fan of kind of pedals and amps and analog stuff. You're very much in that camp. You have put your feet firmly in the camp of real effects and real amps and valve stuff and that sort of area. Whereas I have been recently seduced by the sort of digital world since I got a Line 6 Helix. And I was like, hey, I can have all these cool things that I used to, you know, have cable issues with live and things would break. Now I can have all these things in a really safe space in one pedal board. And, you know, where I would have to buy a new pedal every week, I now can just wait for the next update and get 10 for free. So I've been sort of seduced by that, like, digital thing with the Line 6 Helix, which is certainly, if nothing else, the most prolific of all the multi-effects things. They release the most new updates of any of the brands. And then we've got Matt, who is kind of straddling both of these areas. So Matt works for Boss, obviously, the ultimate stomp box company, who also, you know, have the GT1000, of course, and the MS3, you know, amongst other things, which are, of course, digital multi-effects units. So he's in both camps. He's sort of straddling two horses, as it were.
It's very talented.
Well, what's interesting with the Boss thing is, if you look at, obviously, we make a little bit of everything. And if you look at compacts, what's interesting is the last analog compact we did up until JB2.
I was going to say, surely the JB2.
MD2 was the last analog pedal.
Wait, what's the MD2?
The Mega Distortion. Okay. I think that was the last analog pedal we made in the compact line for like 8 years, 9 years maybe, until the JB2 really? Came rocking around. Yeah,
wow. Really?
But you've got I say that the CE2 maybe.
Yeah, the CE2, the Dimension Chorus, the DM2W.
Yeah, but the DM2 came. Yeah, I'm thinking of analog. Actually, maybe I'm thinking of analog drive circuits. But then again, CE2 was the only wah pedal for a while. BD2W. And SD1W, but we already made those. So it wasn't really... Well, we made a version of the circuit, but the JB2 was the first new analog circuit we'd done for some time, because all the other standard compact range, so not Wazer, obviously, was all digital. So a lot of the drives and everything...
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if you're saying this, if your argument is that Boss is moving more digital, I would say that the Wazercraft is probably your best-selling stuff at the moment.
I'm just saying it's interesting how we are really between both, because compacts are moving towards a more analog feel. If you take the Wazer things, but then obviously the standard compact lines, we can really sort of promote the sort of digital side of things. SY1 is a great example of can do in terms of a digital engine.
And there's certainly more on the SY1 than I think there have been. Well, than there have been on any sort of synthesizer pedals before.
Yeah, I imagine trying to build that analog. It'd be amazing. Also ridiculous.
Yeah, but okay. So the reason was, and to bring sort of Blake into this, is, you know, why so reluctant then, Blake, for the digital world? Or what keeps you so very firmly in the camp of the analog pedal world?
So, admittedly, I am an anomaly. So, I also I should kind of clarify some of this. Like, some of my favorite pedals that I own and some of the things that I'm like jonesing for are fully digital. Like, I love digital effects and their uses. You know, like one of my favorite pedals, for example, is the Hologram Electronics Dream Sequence.
Yeah,
that's totally digital. And so I have a lot. Most of, in fact, I'd almost say like it's probably 50-50. But what makes me so reluctant to go like the Helix route or anything is simply my circumstances. I don't have to, so why would I? I have this room out here that, you know, I put a lot of time into making and making it as sound isolated as I could afford to. So it's not soundproof. That's a bit of a misnomer, but that's not really the point of this conversation. but, you know, I made this so I could turn amps up. And so I'm going to turn amps up. And a Helix, I've played them. I've played all of them except the Axe Effects at this point.
Right.
And I think they're fantastic tools. And if I was a touring musician, I would almost certainly be utilizing some of that stuff. But because I don't have to, they're boring to me. Like, I do not care. Like, so I recognize that I'm in a very unique situation. Just like, I see that they're an amazing feat of engineering. They work fantastic. They do exactly what they're supposed to do. And they do a really good job of it. But I can't be bothered to really care because I don't need it. I have no use for it.
Well, that's such an interesting kind of way around to look at it, because I guess, you know, the whole idea of these, and I think one of the biggest reasons that people move on to digital pedals, it may be something that's going to come back later, as it did, you know, back in the 80s when everyone went to rat gear, is I think people think of convenience before they think of sound. And I kind of think that the argument for Helix and GT1000 and XFX and Kemper is the convenience. So you're kind of saying obviously the opposite because you have this particular space. But, you know, of course, the advantage to these digital effects is, hey, if you want all of a sudden to use a, if you want a Boss Dimension Chorus, in your board, rather than having to find the space and make sure you've got the correct amount of milliampage off of your power supply and make sure that your patch cables are in good order, you can simply select a Boss Dimension Chorus from the drop down menu, and then there it is. That's kind of the thing, isn't it? It's convenience. But I guess what you're saying is, it's the opposite of you, but only because of your situation.
Yeah, it's just, if I was in a normal situation, like most guys out, like I said, touring is the biggest example I can see the best use case for these things. Like, of course, you're flying around or you're crammed in a van or something, you can get really, really good sounds with that stuff.
So, do you think it sounds as good, or do you think, in your opinion, do you think that they have managed to emulate these things to a high enough standard?
So I still feel the same way about this as I have for years. It's, if you sat me down with a recording and one was recorded in a great studio with all the best analog everything, and one was recorded on a Helix and they were dialing up similar sounds, if you just gave me a pair of headphones, I don't know that I would be able to tell the difference. But when I'm playing it, oh yeah, you can definitely tell the difference in the
that
feel.
That is exactly what Brian Wampler said on the Friday special last week, essentially. And I think is something that I'm becoming more and more aware of as I become more digitally orientated. you know, was simply that I absolutely, as a recording solution, and when I was doing the bar chords podcast series and I was getting pedals sent, and I could plug those pedals into the effects return and run them through whatever amp, you know, with anything, with sort of, you know, any EQ editing or compressors or anything else I needed in the chain to make that sound right. It was so convenient, and record directly onto my door. It was fantastic, and I think it was a great way to demo pedals. And certainly I've really enjoyed building the boards to play live with my band with the Helix stuff. But I will completely agree that there is something still unobtainably that I can't put my finger on.
Do you know what it is
about analog?
Yeah. So the thing for me is with stuff like Helix, or Kemper, for example. You know, someone said to me, you know, Kemper is a great recorded guitar sound. The one thing I can never get past, and you know, I programmed a bunch of patches for GT1000. I love GT1000, but I can never get over the sound of hearing it through monitors, and I always want to hear it through an amp, because I want to feel the push and pull under my fingers. And that's why I like things like Katana. If I'm going to use something with a load of effects and I'm going to sit there and noodle about, or even like I have a little microcube under my desk, an old microcube. I love using that because I actually get the feel of a real amp and some like guitar speakers rather than monitors and everything just coming from the unit. You do lose a little bit of depth in some way. Until you start using things like powered cabs, or you run it into like a power amp, like a Seymour Duncan, what is it, the 700, you know, they're sort of like solid state power amp. That starts to make a difference. But I think I'm almost in the same camp as Blake, really. I don't play in a band. Like if I was playing in a band and I wanted convenience, then I would see something like an MS3 as a really good option. But
I would count the MS3 outside of this. The MS3 is... like there's no modeling on the MS3, and I think that's true.
But then again, I've seen a lot of people run an MS3 and then use the MIDI from the MS3 into like an HX stomp. Do you know what I mean? I can see like doing something like that as a portable fly rig, or you know, even just for band practice. But because I never take anything out home, I can just build the most ridiculous thing I want, and I can just use whatever I want. You know, and I think that's why Never, you know, and I had GT1000 here for months, and I'm just like, I keep using my pedal board because I just use a switcher and MIDI, and it pretty much does everything for me.
Yeah, there is definitely a certain type of person. I think there's a reason that the metal scene have embraced it so well, because I think, generally speaking, the sort of modern metal scene tend to be more, more geeky, more techie.
I tell you what was interesting, right? So I don't know if either of you have seen recently, this one random guy with a pretty small YouTube channel ended up doing a rig rundown with Jim Root from Slipknot. And I think he just messaged him on Instagram. Yeah, he just messaged him on Instagram, and Jim Root just went, hey, come and do like a rig rundown sort of thing, because I think he reviewed one of his guitars. And he's running through his rig and he's like, you know what, every album I was changing the rig, I was doing all of this, I was like tone chasing basically, you know, and I've got like a couple of hundred guitars and like 100 amps. And then he was like, but then I realized, you know, I just suddenly thought, I'm playing down-tuned metal, which through amps that are being mic'd up and then fed through a desk and then pumped out through a PA. He's like, all it needs to do is sound good in my in-ears. He's like, that's all I want. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, you can go down this complex route. And he's like, we've got a Kemper. And he's like, you know, we might have that, you know, backstage for warming up. And he's like, I want to feel a real amp. But at the end of the day, there's not much point in like going massively down this kind of route of all this digital stuff, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really make a difference.
We're
just
playing using
down-tuned
half
metal.
Of it,
And I think, and I think that's why you say like some of these sort of modern metal guys, you know, there's a couple of sounds they want. And actually, I was going to say, you know, they obviously do have dynamics in their sound, but the sound they have, you know, if you listen to someone like Meshuggah, is this brutal wall of sound, you know, or if you listen to guys like Pliny, and the sound they have, you know, is very almost clean. It sort of sits in these barriers, I almost find.
Well, I would say neither of those bands are dynamic, you know, not in comparison to sort of to someone playing sort of blues or or prog or anything like that, where you might use effects change, you know, to your advantage. You know, so the modern metal isn't dynamic; it is one sound. It's funny that those genres are sort of aiming for the digital stuff more, I guess.
Well, and it was interesting. This is a really interesting path that we've continued down, because I posed this question from my Facebook group, but I asked Nick Reinhardt the similar line of questioning.
Because, of course, he doesn't use a switcher, which I've always thought weird.
And it's all down to, basically, without spoiling it, you can go check it out if you want, but he basically said it's just not how he likes to work. Like, he's played the Helix, he had nothing but good things to say about it, but he's just like, I like to look down and see a whole bunch of pedals. And at the end of the day, if that's what you like and it makes you more inspired to create that way, I think that's the right answer. Same with the Helix. I'm also much more of a jerk on the internet about the Helix than I actually feel. I'm always like, boo, 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 boo on Helix, gross, in the forums and stuff. But I don't feel that strongly about it.
Sure.
No, I guess, it's a weird one because, same as you, Blake, no need for it. You know, any multi-effects, really, you know. And guys like Nick Reinhardt have basically built a pedal board and then learned to play. What they've done is learned how to use the pedal as an extension of an instrument and kind of really pushed it to its limits. So you're learning how to play the pedal board like an instrument, basically.
Sure.
If you watch him play and how he taps around on things, that's, you know, that's really what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, true. That said, I've seen Terra Melos three times, and twice out of the three times, his pedal board is broken at some point, and he's had to be sort of on his knees trying to troubleshoot a pedal board with no switcher, which is very difficult.
Yeah, I think what was funny is when the last time I saw him, he literally built his pedal board on a piece of wood that was the exact dimensions of his suitcase, and then basically just put his clothes on top, and that's how he was on tour. I was like, brilliant. Lovely guy. Nick.
I love him too, but he is completely ridiculous. So this kind of segues quite nicely into a couple of polls that I put out on the Guitar Nerds Facebook forum, facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds forum, where I asked people two questions. I first asked everyone on the group what their preferred switcher or multi effects is, or if they don't use one at all. So, you know, I gave them the options of all the Helix family, the Boss MS3, the Boss ES series, other stuff, you know, which, and I actually separated out Gig Rig, but I realized other stuff can be sort of Head Rush, the Moore One, Gig Rig, like sort of anything, all those other things, and of course no switcher was an option, and it kind of panned out, I guess, sort of how I expected it to. More people said, and it's kind of a third more people than any other category said they don't use any switcher at all.
Disgusting.
The next one up was the Line 6 Helix family, which we kind of expect. I think it's the most developed and the most price accessible out of all the switches, and you know, it's been around longer than the GT1000. It's cheaper than Axe FX. You know, it's cheaper than Kemper. So it's obviously
depends what Kemper you go for.
Well, the Helix LT is about £750, and I don't know what it is in the US but it's
so ugly though. No one likes the LT. Everyone buys the full one.
No. Lots of people get the LT, and lots everyone of people gets get the Stomp. The Stomp.
So ugly.
That's the one.
Yeah, the Stomp.
The Stomp is actually the one. The Stomp is the one that's firing on all cylinders at the moment. Anyway, so no switcher first. Line 6 Helix came in second. Of course, the others came in third, because that was a big load of people saying, oh, I made a switcher myself. Oh, I use Headrush or etc. The MS3 seeded above the ES8, which I thought was an interesting sign of the times, because I think when the ES8 came out, everyone with a big pedal board was getting one. But the MS3 for me still offers, you know, pretty close to the same flexibility, because some of those inbuilt effects are so damn good. And then it just allows you to have a sort of smaller pedal board. But I thought it was interesting that no switcher came out top in that. So I put out a second poll specifically for the people who had answered that they don't use a switcher, because I wanted to know why. I wanted to know whether it was whether it was that they didn't want to spend their money on something that switches between pedals when you can do that with your pedals, you know, anyway. Whether it was because, and I suspected it was because people just play at home. I expected a lot of people on the Guitar Nerds forum and a lot of guitar players just play at home. So why would they want a switcher? And then I included other things like what Nick Reinhardt had said on your podcast, where, you know, he likes the tap dancing. He thinks it's a more organic experience. But funnily enough, the number one reason, the thing that most people said, that the reason they don't use a switcher or multi-effects is because they are too expensive. And secondly, see, that second place was that they don't use enough pedals to warrant it. That makes sense. And that was kind of the one I expected to come out number one. I was really surprised that switches being too expensive came out above that. But I guess, you know, because of course you can pick up a Moore switcher for about 100 quid. But yeah, I mean, how much is an ES-8 these days, Matt Knight?
Good question. Joe Branson.
Wow. Yeah, I mean,
well,
wow.
I worked RRP, obviously, so that would throw most people off. And I worked Euros in my day job.
Right, okay. That's fine.
So
it's fine.
£512 currently from all good music retailers based in the UK.
Right, okay.
It's way heavier than I would have thought it was.
it does. It weighs a lot. That is,
wow. You guys should really work on that. I know.
Yeah. It's more than Big Van Vader. That is a lot.
Yeah,
a big weight.
I tell you, the one thing that gets me is, I like tap dancing. I think it's more organic for creating sounds. I rebuilt my pedal board after Summer Nam properly because I got a couple of Chase Bliss pedals, which you talked about, and kind of really thought about what I was doing with my ES-8, because I tend to rebuild my pedal board like every year anyway, and I tend to factory reset the ES-8 and start again from scratch. And having so many MIDI equipped pedals on my board now, the Chase Bliss stuff, which does a lot, and yeah, the Eventide H9, and then obviously the ESA also sending out analog control switches for turning things on and off. I found it, basically, it's like building your own multi-effects unit, because things like the ESA allow you to have the foot switches momentary or latching. So, for example, on some patches, I've set it so, you know, the foot switch acts as the, you know, up pushing down a pedal like a whammy, or it momentarily brings in like a shimmer reverb, but because you've got, you can add trails to the ESA in terms of the loops. You can have a momentary shimmer reverb, and then when you take your foot off, it just decays naturally. It doesn't just cut off like most loopers. And I actually think you can start to use a looper like the brain of a multi-effects, except it's not got everything built into it. You're putting what you want into it, and then you can really start to unlock stuff out of the gear that you wouldn't get before.
I completely agree. I think the sort of argument for it being more organic is simply that what you're describing still requires a massive amount of pre-planning. However, if I'm in the middle of a band practice writing something and I suddenly think, you know what, this section requires all my drive pedals to be on and my delay pedal to be sort of maxed out and oscillating. Unless I've set up those pedals to work together on the ESA already, I can't do that whilst writing. I've got to sit down and sort that. I've got to ask the band to hold on a minute, guys. I'm just going to sort of mess around with my ESA like a nerd in a bedroom.
Actually,
if I just had pedals, I'd just turn them all on.
This week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Celestion and their brand new Ruby Alnico guitar speaker. Purpose built to create rich, beautiful vintage tones, the Ruby oozes a richly musical warmth with mellow highs and a smooth, sophisticated mid-range that always seems to sound just right. The classic Alnico speaker shape and lush, deep red colour ensures Ruby really looks the part in your cab and guarantees that no one could possibly mistake this remarkable new guitar speaker's family history. Check out Celestion's new Ruby at retailers including Lean Business in the UK, Tube, Amp Doctor in Germany, Algam in France, Eco Music in Italy, Ebelaud in Spain, plus Gear for Music, Toman, and The Back Shop. And in the USA, you can buy through retailers like Sweetwater, Musicians Friends, AMS, Parts Express, Loudspeakers Plus, and of course Amazon. And for more details, check out Celestion.com.
But the ES8's got manual mode. So you just go to manual mode, turn the pedals on that you want, hold down the memory button, saves it.
That's an excellent argument for it, yes, of course.
But yeah, no, I mean, you know, I know not everyone's going to use a switcher. And I wish, it's one of those things that, you know, working on the other side of the industry and, you know, working for a brand that, you know, my job is to push these products and inform people about these products and be a brand ambassador, as it were, and, you know, market them to the big wide world. You do have to think about how people are going to demo them in stores. And switch is just one of those things that you're not going to go into the store and go, yeah, can I try an ES8 with 8 pedals, please? And can you show me how it hooks up via MIDI? You know, so you kind of have to know and do your research and get it home and kind of experiment with it. And it can be a frustrating process. And actually getting into MIDI can be a very, very frustrating process for the first time.
I mean, I still don't understand how it works at all.
But I think ultimately that's the problem with Helix.
What do you mean? That's the problem with Helix.
The learning curve
is really sharp. Yeah. Oh, it's really sharp. It's a really sharp learning curve. With all of the multi effects like that, I think. Yeah. You are going to definitely want to sell it. Like, listeners, if you're going to buy one, you're going to want to sell it after the first 2 weeks, maybe three, maybe four, and then eventually you will have a breakthrough. That's just how it will be. Blake, do you use a switcher of any form?
Well, you guys already know the answer to this.
Yes, yeah, I do.
I don't even have a pedal board. Like, that's just, I'm playing my pedals with my fingers most of the time, actually. 99% of the time I have my pedals up at, like, you know, just right above waist height, and I'm playing them on a table. So it's, again, my unique, weird situation that I found myself in.
Wait, what are you playing them with at waist height if you're using both your hands on your guitar? Because that's not appropriate.
I guess I should make a video about that sometimes. I do a lot of manual manipulation of the effects. You know, not everything has expression control, and sometimes I wish it did.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly turning knobs and adjusting settings while I'm playing. It's kind of become a weird part of, like, how I play. It's like, oh, this part's coming up and I have to let that note drone so I can turn this knob right now. And so
cool.
It's a weird kind of dance I'm doing.
Do you think a switch would ever be anything you'd integrate, or do you think it's totally against the way you play?
No, not at all. I think they're awesome. In fact, Matt probably remembers, when the ES8 first came out, I was obsessed with the idea of having one. And I remember talking to Matt about it a bunch and talking to some other people. And then my good friend Leon from Pelican Noiseworks, he got one. And he got a really amazing pedal board set up with, like, all the Chase Bliss stuff, and he had this space station at his feet, and he brought it to band practice, and I was like, I played with it for a little bit, and I was like, oh, this is, like, more than I need to deal with right now. And it was one of the rare occasions where actually trying something fizzled me out a little bit, but then it's not because there's anything wrong with the product. It was a steep learning curve, and I wasn't ready for it. But, some of the stuff still fascinates me about the ES8 in particular. The way you can switch the routing around is amazing to me. And I feel like I'm missing out on new sounds by not having one. So I probably will get one in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the routing switching, that's something that you always go on about, Matt, as well, as being a sort of a huge advantage to you for when you use the ES8. It's not something I've ever used on the MS3. Actually, I guess I can do it on the MS3. Can I do it on the MS3, Matt?
Yes. You can. The MS3 will allow you to... You can... The only thing... You can move everything around apart from the analog loops, basically. Because...
Oh, wait. Ah, so I can't... If I set L1, my first loop, as my drive, for example, and L2 as my delay, I couldn't ever run L2 before L1.
No, because they are fixed.
Right,
because
but you can do that on the ES8.
You can do that on the ES8, yeah. You can move... the ES8 obviously allows you to move any effects block. Because MS3 obviously has to have an analog to digital converter, so it has to take your analog guitar sound to digital and then back out to analog. And it would have to do that for every single loop. So it'd have to have...
Right, so it has to treat all of the loops as one thing.
As one block, yeah. So back into analog and then back into digital and then back out to analog. Where the ES8 doesn't have any... It's just analog and it's just switching in and out.
Because, of course, it's not dealing with any internal digital pedals, so it's fine.
Yeah, but the nice thing is adding things like carryover, for example, you know, is always a good thing to have on analog loops, because obviously if you've got delay trails, you want to have that from patch to patch, for example. Or, you know, you can... One thing I found quite handy is if you've got a delay pedal, for example, like a Chase Bliss one that's got MIDI bypass, you can actually leave the loop on and then...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Just bypass the effect via MIDI and then still move it around the chain. So you could have, you know, repeats being modulated by a delay, but then put it after the chorus, and then, you know, move it around for the next patch. So that's always a nice thing. So if you go down the ES8 route, having analog pedals in there means you can change the order and you can start to do some even wackier stuff. And actually, that's best for drive pedals, working out different combinations of drive sounds, you know, what works what allows you to change what and stuff like that. You know, that's always really good. And but then again, you know, if ES8's too much, that's why I think ES5's a really good option. You know, just five loops.
I mean,
and it's just mono at the end of the day.
And it's not a lot of money either. It's like probably the most affordable switcher available.
Yeah,
it's like a Moore switcher.
There's so many out there now, and there's so many great units. I mean, I think Disaster Area Designs are doing a bunch of really good stuff. RJM seemed to be sort of coming into it, doing a lot of stuff as well. I mean, I wanted an ES8 since the day I got told about it, before it was coming out at NAMM, like 2015, I think, you know. And I remember like seeing the... I think for that NAMM show, they got Thomas Nordegg, who's the guitar tech for Steve Vai, and he was the guitar tech for Frank Zappa, built Steve Vai's pedal board using the ES8 on a non-working prototype, and then that was the display at NAMM. And I remember just looking at that going, oh, this is amazing, I can't wait. And I've sort of always been
You couldn't actually use it.
Yeah, but for years before that, I've really wanted a a gig rig, and I've been lucky enough to know Dan Steinhardt, the gig rig, and I think the product that he makes there is also an incredible product. I think really where the ES8 stands out for me is once you start going down that realm of MIDI and doing stuff via MIDI, it does get really unlimited. Like you can really start to really open up the flexibility of some pedals, especially stuff like Chase Bliss pedals, you know, and doing some things that
I really feel like I need to work out otherwise. What MIDI is, because I kind of feel like that is a whole route that I have no idea about.
I know just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, I think, you know,
it's not really as complicated as perhaps Joe and I make it in our heads. Because once it's been, like, every time I've seen it broken down and explained, you know, at a dummy level like I require, it's like, oh, I think I could handle that. It's really just a time. I think it's just taking the time and learning it. That's all it is. It's not really like this impossibly confusing thing like I make it sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly hope so. One day, I'm sure I will sit down and actually spend some time on it.
If only you had somebody really that could guide you.
Yeah, if only. Really, I should just demo some of the sounds I've got on my pedal board at some point on Facebook or something. Because I think, yeah, once you start thinking about it creatively, you know, I think one of the early things I did when I was really messing around with it is obviously ES8's got expression output, which is analog. You could just go stereo cable out into a pedal. And it's got the ES8 has got internal waveforms. And that will transmit over the analog expression out. So you can use a button as a trigger, for example, to trigger a waveform that will send over analog expression. So one thing I did was I was like, right, okay, I'm going to plug it into the rate control of my DM2W. But you can set the expression width, as it were, from 0 to 127. So I said, I'm going to do 0 to 10. So that was moving the delay time from like 10 milliseconds to 30 milliseconds and then send that out via the ES8. And I was like, I've basically made like a chorus pedal, because a chorus pedal is just a fluctuating, you know, delay time effectively.
Right.
And I was like, so you can start to do really weird stuff, like, you know, rapidly changing analog delay times. And I think, you know, once you get into that sort of realm, you realize you probably can't do it in a gig situation. And that's why you have an ES8 when you play at home.
that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Now, boys, we are you know, like two-thirds easily into this podcast, and we haven't spoken about a single guitar yet. We have only spoken about effects, and I'm aware that is absolutely that's terrible, and also not a lot of people's bags. So we should remedy that. Let's do that by diving headfirst into a big bag of news. So first up on the news, actually, before we even deal with any news items, and this, Blake, I apologize for this, but this is just for people in the UK currently. Now, we know we're something like 2 weeks away from the UK Guitar Show in London. If you want to go to the UK Guitar Show, we're going to be there. We're going to be hanging out. I'm going to be drunk. I'm planning on drinking a bottle of gin before I get there. So if you want to see a man falling on £4,000 guitars for a few hours, then you can actually do that for cheaper than you could if you weren't listening to this podcast, because you can get 20% off with Guitar Nerd. So if you just go to the UKGuitarShow.com and you use the code GuitarNerds20, then you can get 20% off. Come down. We're going to be there. I really want someone to hang out with, because currently it's just me and Mark Packham going. And actually, Matt, are you going?
Yes, I'll be there on the Sunday.
But you're just going with Boss, right?
No, I'm just going on my own accord.
Oh, you're just going? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell me and Matt you were going? Me and Mark?
Why do you think he didn't tell you?
I mean, I've been going.
Blake, that is really weird, Blake, that he's done that to us. It's really weird.
Yeah, I can't believe he would do that.
I mean, I booked my tickets like last week, but I've been going for like since last year when I went by myself.
I'm sorry about last year. I drank a lot the night before. I woke up late. I was too hungover to get on the train. So, I do apologize.
Yeah, Joe.
But anyway, if you'd have told me, Matt, I could have got you 20% off. But that's right, listeners, you can get 20% off by using the code GuitarNerds20 on UKGuitarShow.com. Speaking of 20% off, you'll actually, you know, if you're not a Patreon, then you will have already heard at the start of this episode, we're doing 20% off of, you can get 20% off of EarDial earplugs with Guitar Nerds as well by going to EarDial.com/GuitarNerds. They're really good earplugs, which is kind of why we approached them to do a deal. They're really cool, and then they're pretty affordable. And yeah, if you fancy looking after your hearing, bear in mind those earplugs come with a free app that kind of does like noise levels in a room. I kind of thought that was a really cool thing. Anyway,
wow.
Enough about, you know, sort of discounts that you get for listening to the Guitar Nerds podcast. Matt Knight, let's talk about these real NOS new old stock Fenders.
Something that you definitely would want a discount on if you're as poor as me.
Yeah, you don't get any discounts through Guitar Nerds on these. I'm sorry, listener.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, we've got Fender Original, and then, you know, you've got the kind of the Elites, and then you go up to Custom Shop, and then you're like, oh, if you've got the big bucks, you know, you can go down to Masterbuilt. Well, how about the Fender Certified Vintage range? This isn't really a range. These are real guitars from Fender that are effectively, I would guess, in a way, sort of museum quality guitars that Fender have physically owned at some point, opened up their vaults, cleaned, maintained these instruments through their master builders, and are now offering them up for sale via Reverb. So the Fender Vintage Certified Reverb Shop. So there's five guitars ranging from some 50s ones. There's a really nice 54 Strat.
It's just Stratcasters, right?
It's just Strats that they put up at the moment. But what's interesting is that some of these guitars were templates or served as templates for the American Original and the Vintera offerings, which I think is very cool. They come with an initial inspection and set up from a Custom Shop master builder, a 2-year warranty, Custom Shop warranty service, hand field inspection seat, certified vintage, certificate of authenticity, and a factory and factory case candy in the original cases. And if
this
you live in the
like
US
owning the
oh I was gonna say
Go
if
on.
You live if you live in the US, they'll also hand deliver it.
There you go. Yes. Blake,
oh right,
but the only they unfortunately
there's a problem.
Aren't listening. Sorry, go on.
I was gonna say there's a problem though. They're all Strats.
Are you not a Strat fan, Blake?
They're just kind of boring.
I wouldn't be surprised if they put some others up to see how this goes. I mean, as of us recording this podcast, so Monday the, what is it, the 11th?
10th? 9th.
Monday the 9th. They haven't actually, unless they've sold out already, although I watched the video half an hour after it went live, they aren't even in the shop yet. But, I mean, if I was rich enough, I would definitely buy all five.
Well, this is like the ultimate custom shop of custom shops. This is an actual vintage Fender, but in custom shop new quality, owned by Fender. This is like the ultimate Stratocaster of Stratocasters, surely.
Yes.
It's a cool concept. I didn't know they were doing that. I thought, you know, as much as I'm poking fun at Strats, I don't actually hate them that much, but I think that just the fact that they were able to pull this off is incredible. Like, I mean, I know these are going to be $1 billion and out of the range of any, probably most people listen to this podcast, but it's just a cool thing. It's just a really interesting, cool thing that Fender have done with them, in my opinion.
Yeah,
100%.
My only thing is, I guess these guitars are built to, well, these guitars are now collectors items, and as such will probably be bought by collectors who maybe will play them very lightly. They aren't quite, I guess they're not gigging guitars, as it were. I mean, they could be. They totally could be, but I think the people that buy them, and you know, maybe even if I could afford it, I would probably do the same. And I kind of feel at that point, and I've been lucky enough to play some vintage guitars that have been in amazing condition, and they almost feel like they've got no character because they've just never been played in. And
well, that's
the vintage
interesting, but thought
the vintage guitars that I've played that have been played in feel like they've, you know, they've got stories and you kind of want to play them because they've been worn in. But a guitar that's, I mean, a car that's 60 years old that's barely run is still going to run, but you're probably not going to want to. I mean, my dad owns a 1934 Rover, and he doesn't take it out anywhere where it might get a single drop of water on it, you know, because it's a collector's piece. And I kind of feel that maybe that would be the same with these. I partly hope not. I hope that people do go out and play them. But I think in that sort of condition and the money that you'll probably end up paying, you could probably buy another used one from the same era for half the money and maybe even take it out for well, a gig.
Yeah. Any idea what price these are going to go for?
Well, it was interesting because while I was saying that, I remembered that a few days ago, I always check secondhand listings on stores because I like to see what's out there. And one of the best stores, actually, at the moment, I found has got a really great selection of pre-owned stuff. Is Guitar Village, which is a little store in Farnham in the UK, just outside of Guildford. And when I checked, they had some rather interesting Strats. They've actually got two 62 Strats at the moment, one in Seafoam Green and one in Fiesta Red. The Fiesta Red is in very good condition, you know, light wear, Brazilian rosewood board, and it's £12,000, but the Seafoam Green is in slightly less good condition. It's gone a bit brown, and that was £9,000. And then they also have a Candy Apple Red 62, which is up for
£9,999.
Oh,
that's the
best one. I think if these are in really good condition and they come certified, oh, bizarrely enough, they've also got another Seafoam Green 62 Strat. Some guy must just collect 62 Strats, which is up at 11,000, but it's in slightly better condition. So I would imagine, yeah, with these Fender ones, certified, master built, inspected, that instantly adds value. I would have said 20 to 25. You know, so I reckon it's going to be double the value of what you'd get a well-worn one for.
Blake, what do you reckon?
I'm thinking, man, that seems like a bit of a stretch to go to 25, but I could see it. I would guess they would, if you had to ask me, they would be probably somewhere more in the, like, the 17 is where I would probably price them. But I don't have any, I don't know. I'm just guessing. That was just my assumption. When I seen them, I was like, these are going to be in the high teens. That was my guess.
Blake, what is the most amount of money that you would spend on a guitar, your dream guitar?
Oh, see, I was just thinking about this the other day, and I've been fortunate enough to get to play a lot of really nice instruments and get to talk to a lot of really cool builders who make nice instruments, but I would have a really, now, keep in mind, this would be something I saved up for, you know, years. Like, this would be,
of course, of course. But you'd still have to be happy with handing this sum over, sort of thing.
Exactly. So I think... like, if I found the perfect whatever I was looking for, I think $4,000 is probably the most I would spend, because I've played some world-class instruments that were less than that. So right. it would have to, you know, it would have to be, that's about the most I'd be comfortable, and I wouldn't be comfortable with it. That's just the most I could ever fathom spending.
As well, I think,
and that's in very specific circumstances. So I have a hard time imagining that a $8,000 guitar is going to play $4,000 better than a $4,000 guitar.
Yeah.
I think you get diminishing returns when you get much beyond that.
I think you're completely right. I think the $4,000 mark for me, I completely agree. I think upwards of £4,000, I think difference, it starts to become incredibly negligible, sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think you're paying for the builder, you're paying for the time, you're paying for the woods, really, at that point. I think, you know, 4,000 to me, I think you're right, I think you kind of hit the number on the head. That, to me, feels like a guitar that you could feel all the value in, like, some of the best woods and pickups and craftsmanship, and anything over that, it really has to, like, excel in all of those areas, because it's still going to sound great, it's going to play great. But yeah, you kind of want, you know, the best of the best when it comes to woods, or, you know, who built it. And I guess that's why the master built, you know, a master built Strat, is it going to sound better? I don't know. I've played master builds and they do feel amazing, but they're still using the same materials. It's just one person has paid attention to it for its whole
journey. I've got an issue with the fenders above that sort of price point, just because of the nature of the build, just because they are sort of very simple bolt-on instruments. I kind of feel with Fender,
I think the thing is you
could
balance...
never ever go past or any bolt-on. I don't think I could ever happily go past the $2,500 mark. Not on a new one.
To that point, you know, something I never thought of before, and you would think I'm kind of shocked that I never thought of this or had this kind of explained to me, but I did a podcast with Andy from Whale Hazard Guitars, who makes some really nice, super nice high-end guitars here in the States, and he mentioned some of the problems with building a set neck guitar that I never even thought of, and that is when you go to finish it, how much more work it is just to finish it versus a bolt-on. I don't know why that never occurred to me, but once you've got a set neck guitar, it's, you know, regardless of if you prefer bolt or set neck, that's not really the point. The point is once you have a set neck guitar, it's a burden to like transport, to finish it, to everything that you do with it just becomes harder. Whereas Fender style guitars, you can unbolt them and manage the parts on their own, and it's just a lot easier to deal with. I just never thought of that before.
No, yeah, I completely agree. And I kind of think that expertise, that sort of extra care, that should contribute to the price more. I mean, that's kind of why I spent, you know, £4,000 on my Gibson ES 175, and I would never ever dream of spending that amount on a Fender or anything that was bolt on, because I know how much very specific, incredible work went to not just, you know, building that guitar, finishing that guitar, but kind of transporting that guitar as well, and keeping it in one piece to get to me. And I think that's why I always think of set neck guitars as being the absolute premium. They've always seemed like a more premium instrument to anything Fender. And I think I would be interested in spending more money on a vintage Fender, because I think they age so blooming well. And I think there are some, especially from the 60s, I've played some Fenders, some, you know, 60s Fenders from sort of Strats to the 69 P bass that I own, that I'm like, well, this is literally the best sounding thing I have ever, you know, played. So it's, you know, there's definitely some value in that. We should try and get through one or two more pieces of news. We're definitely going off on tangents a lot.
Shocking.
Yes, Blake, why don't we go with a piece of news that you're going to host for us? And sticking with Fender, Britt Daniel. Britt Daniel has got his own signature thin line Telecaster.
Yes, okay, so first of all, for those who don't know, that would be the artist from Spoon, or one of the artists in Spoon, which I didn't know because I'm not the biggest Spoon fan.
Me neither.
But not knocking or anything. I just don't listen to him that much to know whether I'm a big fan or not. But that guitar looks beautiful.
Absolutely. What an absolutely cracking guitar, and a really interesting guitar for Fender to introduce in their artist range.
Yeah. You want me to read the specs off here?
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Okay. We got a thin line ash body with Amarillo gold lacquer finish, a deep C-shaped neck, 9.5 radius, 22 medium jumbo frets, custom shop hand-wound vintage style single coil bridge pickup, custom shop hand-wound Texas special single coil tele neck pickup, S1 switch for series/parallel, and classic gear tuning machines. It's also semi-hollow, so because it's a thin line, as everyone probably figured out when we said thin line.
Yeah.
Awesome Telecaster in thin line in a really unique gold finish, because this is what was the name of it? It's Amarillo gold, which is kind of like butterscotch, right? It looks like butterscotch to me.
It looks like butterscotch, but somehow kind of better.
It's a fantastic color coupled with the black plate with black binding.
Oh, that's what did it for me.
Yeah, the black binding is absolutely killer. I can't help but think I would prefer it if it had a rosewood neck, but nonetheless, it looks absolutely.
It's really similar to the old deluxe thin lines. It's just got a much thicker neck on it. That's what it.
Which is what it reminds my jam.
Yeah, it's a cool guitar. I think I only really know Spoon because of Josh from JHS. I know he loves that band, and he's mentioned them a few times. And I've given him a bit of a listen, same as you, Blake. Not listened enough to go, I absolutely love this band, and obviously they've got a pretty big fan base to have this kind of, you know, to have a Fender guitar. I mean, that's the absolute dream. But yeah, it's interesting that they've taken an existing, well, a guitar that no longer exists, because I don't think Deluxe Tellies in that form exist anymore, and just make a few changes to suit his needs. It's a very cool, and in fact, it's gold as well. It's very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, butterscotchery gold. I can't see a price actually that on the sort of the press release just yet.
That's what I was looking for too. But I mean, I'm sure it's not going to be too crazy. It's not a vintage, you know, stashed in a safe guitar, so it'll probably
yeah,
be fine.
Exactly. Again, like a really interesting thing for Fender to go after. They're really changing up. Do you, like, Blake? Do you remember? Yeah, I guess we've spoken about it on the podcast before, but like, probably go back a decade and find a Fender artist model that wasn't a Californian punk band from sort of the previous decade. That just seemed to be all Fender were doing, in as far as artist models were concerned, you know, 10 years ago. And now they just seem to be kind of just branching out and being a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think what it is at least in my view of it, is I think that people are starting to adopt some of the more obscure Fender models from the 70s. Personally, one of my very favorite guitars I own is a 74 Tele Custom. I just love that thing to death. And I think a lot of, you know, there was a lot of stuff for a long time about 70s Fenders being junk. And in my experience, you guys can probably comment on this a little better than I can, but I've played more good ones than I have really bad ones. And I've definitely played some bad ones, but I feel like their reputation for being garbage all throughout the 70s is a little bit misleading. Because some of the coolest guitars ever were actually made during that time frame, and we've just now are getting over the decades of old people saying that 70s Fenders are terrible. And I think a lot of younger artists are embracing it, and then, like, of course, Spoon haven't done anything normal, you know. They're always kind of struck their own path out, you know. And I just think some of the 70s Fenders are becoming hot right now, and that's why we're seeing so much of that.
Here's an interesting one for you. Maybe the ones that you're playing are good, because the ones that are rubbish, no one can sell. So the ones that you actually manage to buy are the ones that people are like, oh, actually, this is a good one. So I might stand a chance of selling it.
You owned a rubbish one, Matt.
I know. That's why I'm always going to have a bee in my bonnet about that, because I owned a really rubbish 72. It wasn't rubbish. It just was nowhere near as good as the Esquire that I let go to buy it. And I will forever regret that that decision, basically.
I understand. It makes sense.
But yeah, I completely agree with Blake. I actually think the 70s have some completely fantastic stuff. And it's not just 70s stuff. The reissues of things that have happened in the 70s I think are fantastic as well. If you look at, like, Fender Japan, one of my favorite Fender Japan models is their 72 Telecaster reissue.
Yes.
That they did throughout the late 80s and the early 90s. It is absolutely killer. It is one of the best sounding Telecasters you will ever hear. My friend Pete Lambry from the band Alma has played one exclusively throughout his entire career. An old sort of, it looks brown. I don't know what, I've never seen anything like it. But yeah, the 72, the Japanese 72 Telecaster. I love the big, bold Telecaster font on the headstock, the oversized thing. It always looks super cool. But I don't know what it is about those Japanese 72s. But listener, if you ever get a chance to try one of those, made between sort of 84 and like 92, something like that, they were completely killer. Blake, have you ever got to try a Japanese 72 Tele?
Not that guitar specifically, but I do know that one of the coolest guitars I've ever played was a Japanese Jaguar. I don't remember what year it was, but it was from that era somewhere in there.
Was it the double humbucker one?
No, it was a regular, it was just a, was it a Crafted in Japan? I don't really know that that makes, or no, wait, I'm getting that.
Major Japan is pre-94, 95. Listener, you might have to correct me there. And then Crafted is post.
Yeah, so this was a Crafted, and it was, for all intents and purposes, as far as I am aware, this was about 6 years ago, it was just a regular Jaguar reissue. I don't think there was anything like different about it as far as I'm aware, but it was just a great playing, great sounding guitar. It really made me start kind of jonesing over a lot of the Fender Japan stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. The Fender Japan stuff, I think, just consistently has always proved to be fantastic. I have so much time for it. In fact, like, I have so many friends that sort of before I sort of infected them with just being a guitar geek, certainly when we were growing up, they were all like, wouldn't touch anything other than Fender Japan. They were very much like, Fender Japan, that's the type of guitars that they would go for. And in fact, my guitarist Tim, Pete, who we grew up with, both of them only bought Japanese Telecasters quite specifically, until, you know, I sort of talked them into weird boutique brands and sort of parting with thousands of pounds for that sort of thing. Anyway, we are actually pretty much up at time. That's kind of it for us here on the regular episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. We're going to be continuing over on the Patreon episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast, where for as little as $1 a month, you can support the podcast. $1 a month gets you the regular episode ad-free and early. $5 a month gets you access to the Patreon special episode every week, plus you get early listening to our new Friday special series. And $10 a month makes you an executive producer, and it gets your name sung in a song, which I'm actually moving it around. So the song is going to happen at the end of the podcast. Now you get to finish the podcast with the incredible song. I'm actually very, very happy with what I've put out this week. It's absolutely me firing on all cylinders. But you can follow Guitar Nerds on Instagram, at Twitter, at Guitar Nerds. You can join us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Guitar Nerds Forum. And you can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Guitar Nerds. Blake, why don't you tell everyone where they can check you out in your various forms?
So if you like me saying nonsense in your ears, which you probably didn't, but if you did, you can check out everything at tonemob.com. You can go subscribe to the Tone Mob podcast, and it's a little different than this. It's me blabbering to a different guest every week. So it's an interview style format, and it's usually a lot of just a lot of fun. So if you want to find that, and then Instagram's the social that I like and participate in the most. So I'm at the Tone Mob on Instagram.
Excellent. Yes, and we're over on the Patreon, we're going to be continuing some news, because we've barely got to the tip of the iceberg of this week's news. So we're going to try and hammer through as much as that as possible. And also, there's a wonderful treat if you are a Patreon listener. We're going to have a quiz for Blake, which you can also participate in, dear listener. The quiz is going to be, which Guitar Nerd host is Blake the most like? So you can play along with Blake and find out which Guitar Nerd host you are the most like as well. But we'll see you next week for more of this guitar nerdery. Right. Farewell.
Bye. Here we go. Get ready. I want to see you moving. Gary Patillo, Mark Hizow, Katowacki, Rob Bosco, Stephen Bug, Robert Butterworth, Neil Milton, Maren Peters, Stuart Robson, Jeffrey Rax, Christine Von Hansen, John Pearson, Zach Melton, Keith Adams, Steve Ferguson, Eric File, Andy Joyce, John Anglin, Adamos Crisp, Jake Cutler, Rob Gruhl, Scott Hamilton, Tucker Amadon, Ernie Cooper, Ross Edwards, Nate Nagel, Stephen Hench, Rob Grant, Matt Roberts, Dave Lee, Regent Baker, Juan Correa, Aaron Sherman, Blake Wyland, Andrew Good, Jamie Kemp, Jake Gray, Matt Bellamy, Martin Cliff, Scott Kennedy, Christopher Loseth, Hans Ams, Robin Smith, Derek Rich, Chris Connors, Robin Nordvik, Duncan Watson, Ed Bentley, Steve Merkel, Carlos Manger, Annie McKenzie, Brad Page, Claire Tom, Scott O'Brien, Laurie Ansis, Paul Corrigan, Will Clare, Moo Gravett, Phil Thompson, Adrian Day, Ken Sayers, Matthew King, Scott Kane, Sean Harbo, and Christopher Wolfman Caputson! Oh! We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds, like the breathable, silky, smooth Tree Runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Dasher, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds tree shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of Tree Dashers, Runners, Pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.